Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and I'm at the Royal Court Theatre today to talk to the award-winning playwright Anders Lustgarten, whose debut at this address is the beautifully titled play If You Don't Let Us Dream, We Won't Let You Sleep, which completes its run in the theatre downstairs at the end of next week. His other plays include A Day at the Racists, Enduring Freedom and Socialism is Great. As well as being a writer, he is also an international political activist. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Anders.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
Could you start off by telling us a bit about how this latest play came about?
Absolutely. I mean, it really came about with austerity. And as you mentioned, I do a lot of political activism work. And what's fascinating about austerity is it's actually a lot of development politics coming home. So the things that are being done in this country now and in Southern Europe particularly, are things that have been done in Africa and Latin America for 30 or 40 years with very similar results, which is the collapse of growth, which is a lot of impoverishment, which is a tiny elite taking most of the resources. So it's fascinating to see how people are starting to get to grips with what austerity is really about. But for me, austerity was always very clearly a form of political coup. Yeah. It was never and has never been intended to fix the economy. Yeah. And I mean, in developing countries, for example, the rate of growth since the sort of neoliberal austerity policies kicked in the 70s is half what it was from the 40s to the 70s onwards. So even on its own terms, it's a total failure. But I think you need to see it in terms of what they're really trying to do. And I felt very strongly that you need to debunk this basic myth that austerity is trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And that's really where the initial impetus for the play came from.
And was it a commission for the Royal Court?
It was, yeah. Yeah. It's originally the idea was a sort of bifurcated view of the immediate future of British politics. Mm. Half sort of sliding into what I regard as a kind of financial fascism and half a sort of optimistic potential alternative. I think it's really essential to have both of those. It's really essential to understand what finance is actually doing to us, how it really works and what it really means. But it's also totally essential to have something optimistic. And that, more than anything, is the most satisfying response I've got to this play from a lot of people who just say, thank God there's something optimistic about it. Thank God there's something in it that makes us feel, whether we agree with it or not, whether we think it's too naive or too nebulous or not, that actually puts out the beginnings of a different argument.
Yeah, I think that's true, because the problem with talking about austerity and about economic collapse and so on is that often it's very gloomy. It seems as if there really is not an alternative.
And then people get depressed and they just sink into a glass of wine, and you're never going to make any significant headway in political change if you just depress people. Yeah. I actually think I'm working on a project with Sean Holmes and Simon Stevens at the Lyric in the autumn called A Manifesto for Radical Optimism. And I really think optimism is the most radical political position you can take right now, because most people are repeatedly banged over the head with how bad things are. And unless there's a chink of light, unless there's a sense of... Because people don't change the world unless they're inspired to do it.
Yeah.
They do under duress, but unless they've got something, a vision of something better, a vision of something that brings us together. And there's so much potential for that, because the real source of a lot of social discord is our atomization, is how fragmented we are by capitalism. And the sense of people joining together in whatever form. Mm. On the one hand, because we're so unused to it, some people sort of laugh at it. They see it on the stage, they see the second half of these people in quite a deliberately naive way throwing around these possible ideas. And people sort of laugh because they're so unused to it. And they've sort of almost got to go back to the 70s to imagine.
And that's one of the reactions you've had, is it, from the audience? No,
they listen. The reaction you get in the room is an absolutely intense energy. It's the best environment I've ever had in a theatre. It's the best environment I've ever heard in a theatre. Just that degree of intense listening. You can hear a pin drop a lot of the time. Yeah. And people come out just energised. A lot of them really inspired. A lot of them deeply irritated and in disagreement and in arguments. Oh. I mean, I love that. I mean, there was a brilliant thing last night. I was in and there were four people, quite well-dressed, you know, classic Sloane Square people, which is not necessarily the audience we've got for this, actually, I'll talk about. I didn't think they were going to like it, and I could hear a guy harumphing and grumping. And then his friend turned to him and went, well, I just didn't know which one of them to care for the most. Mm. And then his friend went, no, that was terrible. That was, it was almost a horrendous piece of theatre. And that, I just felt job done. I felt like, that if you've got that level of argument going about the ideas, about the form, about the possibility of difference, that's what I want. I don't want everyone applauding and everyone patting me on the back.
Yeah, because if you have total agreement, it means that what you're saying is unsurprising.
Exactly so. Yeah. Yeah. And if you haven't antagonized the people who do represent impediments to progress, then you haven't done your job. So, yeah, no, I'm extremely pleased. The thing about this play is that we've really attracted, I think, an audience that is what theatres always say they want. A lot younger than usual, a lot more politically engaged than usual, and just open. But there's such a hunger out there, Alex, for people who are willing to talk and think about what's really going on, call it what it is, and talk about something different. I mean, not that I've got all those answers at all, but I'm willing to be honest and just put out there what I think is going on. And there's a massive hunger for that. Massive hunger for that.
Oh, that's interesting. Where did you get the title from? Was that yours? Or
No. All my titles are taken from reality. And that is from the Spanish Indignado movement, which I had quite a lot of involvement with in 2011. So as an activist, I've spent a lot of time in the last 2 years in protest movements against austerity. I spent a lot of time with Occupy here, with the Indignados in Madrid and in Barcelona.
Can you say a bit about the Spanish situation?
The Spanish situation is fascinating because, I mean, we really haven't yet, especially in London, felt the full bite of austerity. But, I mean, Spain has 40% youth unemployment and rising. So literally one in two people has no prospect of a job. And the sense of betrayal of those people, particularly the ones that played by the rules, you know, the ones that went to university and did all the right things and are not natural rioters. Paul Mason, in his book Why It's All Kicking Off Everywhere, calls them the graduate with no future. And that's a very ill-advised group of people to antagonize. Because they're intelligent, they're educated. It's also the people that largely led the Arab Spring. So I've spent a lot of time in Egypt. I've spent quite a bit of time in Tahrir, with the Tahriris, probably more time than I have in Spain, actually. And that's exactly who it is. Those people that were educated, that went to university, that believed that you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you get an education and you'll get your reward at the end. And there's nothing there for those people. And they are intelligent and organized and angry. And that is where the next wave of radical political action will come from.
Can you give a brief outline of the plot? What actually happens?
Sure.
The play's quite short, isn't it?
It's very short and quite direct and very much unlike the well-made play. You know, it's and that's too much for some people, and I've got no problem with that at all. But it's quite direct. It's sort of a little bit Pinter, a little bit Brecht in the first half. It's short, sharp, unpleasant vignettes about what happens when you let the city drive social needs. So there was a very interesting and disturbing thing happening now, where as a result of austerity and cutbacks, they are allowing the city to issue bonds. This people actually, the one reaction to my play that is surprising to me, people all think it's slightly set in a dystopian future.
Yeah,
it's
not. Yeah.
Everything in that play, Alex, is true. Everything in that play is true and it's real. It's either happened in Greece already or it's being trialed. So there's this concept of unity bonds in which essentially the city then gets to bet on the levels of homelessness or rape or re-offence or whatever. And they're trialing those already. They're trialing those in Peterborough Prison. They're trialing those in... Goldman Sachs has been to the EC to try and implement a Europe-wide version of these things. When there's a funding gap and an opportunity for the city to make money on speculation, it's the perfect storm.
And is this because there's so much capital, despite everything, still sloshing about
that people who control money are
looking for opportunities to invest?
So because of the global slowdown, because there is, well, Seamus Milne in an article for The Guardian the other day said the corporations are sitting on $777 billion in uninvested revenues. Because if you look at what you get off a government bond or, you know, a safe investment, although government bonds aren't that safe anymore, they're very, very low rates of return. And so this ethic of what they call the pursuit of alpha returns has sprung up, and it's headed by the private equity boys. And they are looking to go, you know, 20, 30, 100% returns. They're looking for alpha, maximum returns. And the way you get that is through asset stripping. It's through speculation. It's not by, you know, most industries are not going to give you that per year. You know, most industries are solid, slow growth.
Unless so they're in China or India.
Even in China, it's slowing down. So China's gone from double-digit growth down into, it's sinking. And the environmental consequences of that in China are extraordinary. So I actually, my degree is in Chinese, and I went back to China two years ago to write a play about China. And you cannot see in most of the main cities. You cannot breathe. The levels of respiratory, the actual life expectancy rate in Chinese cities is plummeting because of, you know, they basically poisoned the world in order to make those profits. So there's this money sloshing around. People are looking for new forms of investment, especially investments that are underwritten by the public sector. So something that I think is really interesting, I don't completely know what I think about this, but the traditional lefty alternative to letting the market lead is a sort of Keynesian theory, right? Where the state invests in houses or schools or whatever.
Infrastructure.
And they create both jobs and a certain social ethic that comes out. And that was Keynes' quite explicit intention, was to create a social ethic of solidarity. That doesn't exist anymore because there's no such thing as public spending. Public spending is now completely captured by the private sector.
Yeah.
So if you look at, say, the PPP model, the public-private partnership model, which is how we built
hospitals
now.
Schools, yeah.
What they do is they transfer probably three or four times the original cost of the project to the private sector, guaranteed, underwritten by the public forever. And the private sector keeps the asset at the end of it and leases it back to the public. And so what you have there is the complete capture. So the point of the market mechanism is it's meant to be efficient, it's meant to be cheaper, it's meant to be effective. It doesn't work that way. What they're now doing is soaking the public purse
for guaranteed
money.
Look at the utilities, electricity and gas. It's a great example. Or the railways.
Right. Or Iraq. So what Halliburton got in Iraq was what's called costs plus contracts, where they got to go over there and make a guaranteed profit plus whatever cost they racked up. So strangely enough, their costs went through the roof.
Yeah.
So you've got all the worst of the market model with all the worst of the status model for the benefit of a tiny corporate elite. Yeah. So all of those things, essentially you've got to look at what government now thinks its job is, which is essentially to transfer public resources into private hands. Yeah. That is, to me, the fundamental opposite of what traditional government is meant to be about, which is to take private revenues and use them in a social, public, collective way. So government has been completely turned upside down and hijacked. And so the general lefty idea of, oh, well, you know, put more back in the hands of the state, that's gone as well. So what I'm really looking for here politically, and what I'm trying to put out there in this thing, is not an answer. It's a realization of the questions we need to ask.
Yeah.
And the question is not public or private. The question is not if both of those models are horrendous and we know they don't work, because we know that state-centric, you know, central planning really wouldn't work in such a multicultural society with globalization. And we certainly know that, you know, the state's been captured, and we certainly know that the market on its own model is fairly catastrophic. What else do we want?
Yeah. So basically your play shows people in power creating these unity bonds.
Correct.
It also shows several scenes of what happens to society when that happens.
Right.
And obviously it's bad. And then you have a long final scene where your characters assemble and they create the court of public opinion, which is going to be a media event in which they try this model in front of Channel 4 and The Guardian and even the Daily Mail if they're lucky. But I can imagine the coverage, as can you. Within this, you also have two characters.
That's right.
Basically, Ryan, a white working class kid, and MacDonald, a migrant from Zimbabwe. Can you tell us a bit about both those
characters?
Absolutely.
So the first, what I'm trying to show in the play is, so there's something quite interesting about this, the form of conventional theatre, which is it's largely about characters doing things to other characters.
Yep.
And that's only part of the reason why we behave the way we do. And what I'm interested in is what is showing the effects of political decisions or financial models on people and on how people treat each other. So what the first half is about you implement this bond model, which is based on incentives and the kind of, you know, the logic of capitalism. How does that cause ordinary people to treat each other? And so when you're on the tube, for example, and you're stuck in someone's armpit and it grounds to a halt and you're furious, you just want to punch the person next to you.
Yeah.
You don't actually stop and think, well, actually, it's like this because it was privatized, because there's not enough money going into it, because we haven't really dealt, you know, because there's too much pressure on public resources. All the pressure on public resources is only going to get worse, and it's only going to make us treat each other worse.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to illustrate there is the things that people do to each other. And so there's, my favourite scene in the play, because it's the most human, is as a result of that pressure, of that sense of deprivation and that sense of, you know, frustration, Ryan is involved in a racist, violent incident towards MacDonald in the first half. He ends up then joining this Occupy group, as a lot of working class people did, actually, or a lot of working class kids did, because they're looking for something new.
Yeah.
It was surprising to me when I went to Occupy. It wasn't nearly all the kind of lefty, lentil-eating, middle-class kids that you expected it was going to be. There was quite a lot of black people there. There was quite a lot of working-class people there. It was much more diverse than anything. And he joins this not because he necessarily believed 100% in it, but just because he's looking for something else. And then he runs into McDonald again, who has become what has finally managed to pull himself up the ladder and gets the job. His qualifications deserve as a health and safety inspector. And there's a lot of arguments, there's a lot of discussions before we get to that scene. But what I love about that scene is it's just about two people who have been victims of that system making each other vulnerable to each other. It's the vulnerability and the openness in that scene as a counterpoint to a lot of the intellectual argument, I think, for me, is very powerful. And I realised in the course of this, all my plays are about vulnerability. They're always about, they're driven by ideas and they're driven by political, you know, feistiness, but they're always about human vulnerability. They're always about the things we do and we need from each other.
Yeah. And then that vulnerable scene, which is the most moving one in the play, because obviously the different strands come together in a kind of satisfying way, but then suddenly it stops. Mm-hmm. Now, was that deliberate, to stop it just like that and not sort of continue the argument?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, for some people this play is too on the nose, as it's called, or it's not. It's certainly not a well-made play. It's not 3 hours of... I give you one side of the argument and then the other, and then we go deep into characterization.
Yeah.
And if that's not for some people, then I have no problem with that whatsoever. You know, that's fine. But what I didn't want it to be, what I want people to do, Alex, coming out of that one, is I want them to argue and I want them to discuss and I want them to have strong, visceral, instinctive, important responses. My job, and I'm not interested in being patted on the back. My job is to stimulate people, not provoke in the sense of, you know, being a provocateur and just winding them up. It's to stimulate and energize and antagonize if necessary. And I mean, so many people have said, you know, a friend of mine went and she said she came out arguing with the two people on either side of her who she didn't know, and they all wanted to talk about it. And they were all arguing. Another friend of mine, quite a famous actress, said she brought her boyfriend, who's a bricklayer. And he was asleep at the start, didn't want to be there. By the end, he was on his feet shouting and yelling, and they talked about it all the way home. And though that is brilliant, that's the most satisfying response you can possibly get as a political playwright. I don't want everyone to think I'm right. I want them to go away and take it somewhere, and take it wherever they want to take it.
There's a character called Asset Smith.
There is, yeah.
And he talks a bit about markets not being responsible to anybody. Mm-hmm. And you've also got Cameron's speech about how markets are absolutely wonderful and everything. Mm-hmm. Is that, in essence, the problem? This fantasy that there's such a thing as a free market?
Yes, there is, yeah. And the thing about the market is it's an astoundingly clever mechanism.
Yeah.
For completely unequal, cruel redistribution of wealth under the guise of dispassionate, mechanistic, it's nothing to do with me, gov.
Yes.
Detachment. So it's, you know, it's a magical mechanism where right-wing governments can say, this just dispenses resources according to something that's nothing to do with our plan. This is just people working stuff out for themselves. And it's just obviously untrue. It's so obviously untrue because, you know, it favours those who have resources. It favours those who know their way around the system. It favours those who think in materialistic and mechanical terms. And the way that you couldn't possibly get a lot of those redistributions of wealth done overtly, you have to have them done by this mechanism as though it's dispassionate. Yeah. The market is not dispassionate. The market is the most sophisticated and nuanced form of totalitarianism that I think humankind has ever invented. Because all the other totalitarianisms that I know, I studied Maoism quite intensively, I know fascism quite well, they all have this thing about you're either with us or you're against us. You know, you're either on our side or you're not. And market politics says there's room for everybody and everyone's got value and, you know, it's all about choice. And the sort of the dissembling lie of choice is really something that it nauseates me because it basically, it's a fantastic way of blaming the victim.
And it's also what Marxists used to call false consciousness, in which people actively subscribe to things that are going to fuck them over.
And you think about the number of choices that a 16-year-old girl who lives on a housing estate in Bradford and never sees her dad and isn't particularly academic, but is a decent, intelligent, worthwhile human being. And then that same girl who lives in a flat right around here, and her dad works in marketing or as a management consultant. And just the choices those two people have, the same person in those two different socioeconomic circumstances, they are night and day. And to effectively blame the person with the shitty choices for an economic system over which they have no control is just deeply despicable.
There are one or two really good lines. Well, my favourite lines, okay. As you know. One is, debt is our word for love, which character Kelly says in the last scene. Can you talk a bit about that? Because it's in a way, it's very striking, that phrase.
Yeah, that might be my favourite speech, actually. Because it's something to do with the human side of something that we think of as very abstract and financial. And I mean, I just... That comes from... it's a very, very interesting book that everyone should read, called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Good title, by an anthropologist called David Graeber, who I keep meaning to invite to this and haven't. Sorry, David. But it's basically about, this is in the play actually, he was at a garden party with somebody from an NGO, and he was explaining what the IMF really gets up to and why it's so destructive. And the woman just looked at him and went, but they have debts and they have to pay them.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get his head around this idea that idea of debt is so deeply rooted. It can't just be financial. It can't just be that we're told it over and over again. It must have some deep emotional atavistic connection.
Yeah.
And he looks into it, and he looks at the concept of debt around the world in different cultures, and he sort of comes to this conclusion that all our deep sense of social responsibility and obligation we express in terms of debt, and that debt is therefore our word for love. And he doesn't use that. I came up with that myself. But there's just something quite powerful and human about that, because it takes something that we've been talking about in these abstract terms and it roots it down into something so heartfelt and vulnerable that it just really works for me.
And at the same time as illustrating how deep the problem is, you also suggest various solutions to the debt crisis. Mm-hmm. Your characters voice various ideas from around the world. Can you talk a bit about that, because in this country, for example, it seems to be one of these cliches that almost everybody in mainstream politics accepts that we have to pay our debts.
Absolutely.
And that we've got no choice but austerity. But you come up with several sorts of examples. Can you talk a bit about that?
Absolutely. So, again, this is something that you learn. It's very interesting to come with a development background into European politics now, because, as I said, you've seen a lot of this stuff before. And there are examples. There's something called odious debt, which is a concept, entertainingly, that the Americans invented when they wanted to steal Cuba from the Spanish. And that holds that if debt was racked up by a dictatorial elite at the expense of the people, and the lenders knew that in advance, i.e. when they lent to Mobutu in Zaire, they knew it wasn't going to go on a road and water system, they knew it was going to go on a gold-plated aeroplane, then the stuff gets written off. And it has been all around the world. And the most effective model for that is Ecuador.
Yeah.
I have a friend of mine who's a Brazilian economist. She was on the Ecuadorian Debt Audit Committee for 3 years. So they went very seriously through it. It's not just a thing about, I'm not going to pay it.
Yeah.
You go through this stuff in some detail, and you go, okay, this was not racked up in our interest. This was a loan from one elite guy to another elite guy using a public institution. And that is very often what development banks are used for. Actually, development banks are the absolute epicenter of global financial crime. I mean, actually, that's what the banking system is. If you look at financial services is financial crime. It's money laundering, it's tax evasion and avoidance. So this whole idea that we have to protect our financial services industry, that to me is the rotten heart of the United Kingdom. If you have an industry that is basically criminality, and has some spin-off benefits, you know, because it produces other things, you know, whatever, luxury housing and estate agents and things. But you have an industry that is essentially based on criminality and exploitation and facilitating that around the globe, and that's the best thing you do in the country? Yeah. Well, that's going to have not only an economic but a moral effect on your country. And so what's great about the debt audit and the odious debt concepts is that they are taking that stuff seriously on its own terms, and looking at whether it's legitimate or not. And just the concept. There's a bit where Ferdy, who's playing the slightly nerdy guy who's talking this stuff through, he just has this line where he goes, if the bank bailout wasn't in our interest, we don't have to pay it back. And there's always an ooh around the room. There's always a,
ooh?
No.
It's unexpected.
And people are just sort of like, scales falling. Yeah. And that is brilliant. And you know, whatever they do with that, that's up to them. But what I've tried to do very explicitly in this play is inject concepts that are not in the political mainstream as much into the political mainstream as possible. And this play in terms of the effect it's having on audiences, but also in terms of how it's reaching out beyond theatre into, we've had a lot of think pieces, very interesting piece in the Standard, in the Daily Telegraph, Newsnight's going to do something on it. You know, it's really got a reach beyond theatre, and that's very important. You know, if we always question, is theatre relevant? Well, it's relevant if you talk about things that mean stuff to people.
The production, which is directed by Simon Godwin, is called A Production Without Decor.
Right.
It's got a kind of Brechtian feel. Mm, you can see all the lights, the back of the theatre, the wall and everything, and it's quite simple in terms of props and everything. Mm-hmm. Was that also something you wanted, to have that kind of aesthetic, or is
I mean, they told me that was what was going to happen when they decided to do the play, and from the get-go I thought it was a great idea, because it's, you know, it's a stripped-down, austere concept. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to have a highly sophisticated, but I think Simon and the cast have done an absolutely fantastic job of handling the transitions. You know, to play ensemble, it's very fast moving and difficult. You have to have, you have to really suspend your ego, you know, to help each other and to play multiple parts. I couldn't be happier with this cast. They are incredibly good, and Simon's direction is really fluid, it's dexterous, it uses that space very cleverly. Everyone involved in this play is extremely brave, because there's nothing to hide behind. You know, the play's quite direct. There's no set. Yeah. You don't have a lot of, you know, sort of characterization in depth to hide behind. So for the court to put this on downstairs, and for the actors to tackle it the way they have, I'm really, really proud of them.
You've said in another interview that I read that you're an activist first and playwright second. How did you get into theatre then?
Well, I'm sort of... I try and have a slightly more complex relationship between the two than that. I don't want the activism to overdetermine the playwriting, because then, for a start, the audience is always going to be able to tell, you know, where you're going to go with this. So I think my next one is not like that one downstairs at all, and that should be a pleasant surprise. But I got into it because I was working in prison. I was teaching in prison, and I was asked to help a friend do Accidental Death of an Anarchist, which I rewrote to be about the Stephen Lawrence case. And just to watch the prisoners be completely compelled. And so compelled that they would get on stage and argue with their mate, who was in character. In character! And I'd have to get them off the stage, which is, you never want to move large, violent men off a stage. But they were just so captivated by storytelling.
Yeah.
And, you know, theatre at that point wasn't for me. I'd barely been. I really associated it with a somewhat suffocating middle-class environment. And to see the effect it could have on real people... rather than people who went because they knew, you know, and there's nothing wrong with going and being a theatre enthusiast, and you know theatre and you love theatre, that's great. But the people I always want to talk to as much as I can are people who just respond to a story, who don't necessarily go to the theatre, who are not necessarily able to distinguish or want to distinguish between different types of stories, who just respond to a tale. And actually, as somebody who always has something they want to say politically, that's a brilliant challenge, to think of it just in terms of what's going to be good enough about this story or the way you tell it that keeps people's attention.
You've not only questioned political clichés that we're familiar with, but you've also questioned some theatrical clichés. I also read that you said somewhere, never write what you know. Can you talk a bit about that? Because that's the cliché for
totally. I think that's, I mean, funnily enough, this play probably writes more what I know than any other play I've done. And that's largely because, actually, interestingly, Chris Campbell and other people at the court were very keen on me doing that, because they wanted me to reflect that experience that I have and the things that I know. But I always try, even in this play, to learn something. It's just so much more interesting if you learn something you didn't know in the process of writing a play. So, for example, Day at the Races, which you mentioned, which is about the BNP, but it's mainly about New Labour's abandonment of the working class.
Yeah.
I started that play, the first half of that play is a pro-BNP argument. It's why would somebody who is part of the abandoned working class be drawn into the BNP? And we can see the slightly more amenable form of the BNP, which is UKIP, you know, are drawing in a lot of people. And it's just much more interesting if you go beyond your own visceral instinct. And I've got very strong opinions, as you can probably tell from the play. But it's just more interesting for me if I discover something and I learn about things from a different angle. There's an element, I think, that therefore is residual in the writing, of surprise and tautness and discovery, rather than straightforward lecture and pedagogy.
And what's your next play going to be about, or... aren't you prepared to say?
Yeah, I can talk about it. Well, I mean, I've got a couple of things. One that's quite good fun that's going to be at the Cockpit in May and June, which is there's a play called Kennedy's Children, which I'd never heard of, which is about five characters reflecting on the end of the Kennedy era. And Dave at the Cockpit has got five of us, April DeAngelis and Georgia Fitch and Mark Norfolk and Paula Stanich, to write five different characters reflecting on the end of Blairism.
Ah, wonderful.
So that should be good fun. That was really fun to do. My character is this grumpy Glaswegian Stop the War activist whose son joins the army and goes to Iraq. And then I'm probably going to do a play at the FIMBA in October about Zimbabwe, a play I wrote before we took to Zimbabwe, and there's going to be elections this summer and I will update it and look at that. But the next sort of big project I'm looking at is called The Seven Acts of Mercy, and it's based on a Caravaggio painting which depicts seven biblical acts of kindness. And it's my play is about seven modern interweaving acts of kindness, because that play is about picture is about essentially what made the Good Society in that era. Mm. And mine is about seven contemporary equivalents of the Good Society. So it's a more organic form of radical of optimism, right? The idea that, you know, there are things still that we do for each other and care about each other. And you can, what it's fundamentally about as a critique, because there's always a critique in my plays, is the capitalist consumption of love and the propaganda of love. The idea that we now get so much, you know, Hollywood or R&B, whatever propaganda, of finding the one, and that basically all of human love is meant to be concentrated in finding your perfect partner. And a lot of that is not a conscious political decision. It's a response to the anemy and fragmentation of you know, a competitive consumer society. But it's also a deliberate attempt to eliminate the idea of the form of social love. And I don't think we have... I don't think you're a real, full human being unless you are in a web of something, unless you're in a network of something, unless you feel a human connection to something collective, as well as love for another person. It's not saying you shouldn't love another person. It's just that bizarre propaganda of the one. And trying to reinstall the idea of collective love, if you like, of a social form of love. So that's what that one is about.
Great, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, and it has an aesthetic driver as well. It will be done with that Caravaggio chiaroscuro style.
Oh, yes.
Which I've never written with an aesthetic, you know, what the play would look like in mind. So, man, that play may not work at all, but I always try and bite off more than I can chew as well. I always try and do something where I just go, man, that sounds a bit difficult.
Great. It's just more fun. Good luck, Anders.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.